1918, the guns fell silent. Peace reigned. More than 116,000 American soldiers had lost their lives in the war. The total death toll for all sides was around 17 million. And in that moment of the armistice, the Radium Girls, the company executives, and the world gave thanks that the brutal, bloody conflict was over. Enough people had died. Now, they thought, it was time for living. 4. Exactly 1 month after the armistice, Quinta Maggia put those seize-the-day principles into action, marrying James MacDonald. He was a cheery man of Irish heritage who worked as a chain store manager. The newlyweds set up home in a two-story cottage. To begin with, Quinta was still dial painting, but that didn't last long. She left the firm in February 1919 and soon became pregnant. Her daughter, Helen, would be born 2 days after Thanksgiving. Nor was she the only dial painter to depart. The war was over. The girls were growing up. Irene Corby also resigned, having landed a job as an office girl in New York City. Later, she would marry the rather dashing Vincent Laporte, a man with piercing blue eyes who worked in advertising. Those who left were quickly replaced. Sarah Mileffer managed to get a position for her little sister, Marguerite Carlo, in August 1919. She was a dynamic young woman who wore rouge and lipstick and liked dramatic clothes, smart tailored coats with oversized lapels, and wide-brimmed hats with feathered edges. Marguerite became best friends with the little sister of Josephine Smith, Genevieve, who had also started working there. Another close friend was Albina Maggia, who was still slaving away over her trays of dials, having seen her younger sister marry ahead of her. Albina didn't resent Quinta's happiness, but she couldn't help but wonder when her time might come. That summer, she too decided to leave, returning to hat trimming. It was a time of change all round. That same summer, Congress passed the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. Grace Fryer, for one, couldn't wait to make it count. At the plant, too, change was afoot. Soon, a new chemist and future vice president, Howard Barker, together with von Sahotsky, started playing around with the recipe of the luminous paint, substituting mesothorium for radium. A memo revealed Barker would just mix whatever he had around the place and sell it, 50-50 or 10% mesothorium and 90% radium or whatever. Mesothorium was an isotope of radium, dubbed radium-228 to denote its difference from the normal radium-226, also radioactive, but with a half-life of 6.7 years, in contrast to radium-226's 1,600 years. It was more abrasive than radium and, crucially for the firm, much cheaper. In the studio, meanwhile, the girls, for some unknown reason, were asked to try a new technique. Edna Bowles remembered, "They passed little cloths around. We were supposed to wipe the brush on this little cloth instead of putting it in our mouth." But within a month, Edna said, "They were taken away from us. We were not allowed to use the cloths. It wasted too much of the radium." She concluded, the lips were resorted to as the better way. It was important to the company that the production process be as efficient as possible, because the demand for luminous products showed no signs of slowing, even now the war was over. In 1919, much to new treasurer Arthur Roeder's delight, there was a production high, 2.2 million luminous watches. No wonder Catherine Sharp was feeling tired. That fall, she noticed cracking and stiffness of her legs. She was feeling in poor spirits generally. As her mother had passed away that year, Catherine became closer to her father, William, as they grieved. Yet life, as Catherine's orphaned cousin Irene Rudolph knew too well, goes on, even when those we love die. She and Catherine could do nothing but knuckle down to their jobs, alongside their fellow workers, still toiling in the dust-filled studio, Marguerite Carlo and her sister Sarah Mileffer, Edna Bowles and Grace Fryer, Hazel Vincent and Helen Quinlan, Jenny Stalker and, still making everyone laugh, Ella Eckert and Molly Maggia, who were in fact two of the fastest workers, despite their hijinks at the company socials. They played hard, but they were tough workers, too. You had to be, to keep your job. Still, the endless orders came. The company began to consider its post-war strategy. It resolved to expand its presence in the field of radium medicine. Arthur Roeder also oversaw the trademarking of Undark. Peacetime frivolity meant there were numerous products customers wanted to make glow in the dark. The company now sold its paint directly to consumers and manufacturers who performed their own application. All this gave the radium firm another idea. They planned to set up in-house studios for watch manufacturers. This would dramatically reduce the dial painting workforce in Orange, but the company would still profit by supplying the paint. In fact, the firm had a compelling reason to want to leave Orange, or at least condense operations. The site's position in the middle of a residential neighborhood was proving problematic now that the fervor of wartime patriotism had gone. The local residents started to complain that factory fumes discolored their laundry and affected their health. Company officials took the unusual step of appeasing the residents themselves. One executive gave a neighbor $5, $68.50, compensation for her damaged washing. Well, that was a mistake. It opened the floodgates. Next thing, all the residents wanted money. People in this poor community were anxious to take advantage of the company. The firm learned its lesson. It immediately drew the company purse strings tight, and not a single further dollar was paid out. The executives turned their attention back to the watch company studios. The demand for them was obvious. In 1920, luminous watch production would surpass 4 million units. Arrangements were soon put in place, and everyone was happy. Everyone, it seemed, but the original dial painters. For while the company was doing well through the new agreement, it left the women out in the cold. There was simply not enough work coming in to keep them all employed. Demand dwindled until the Orange studio was running only on a part-time basis. For the dial painters, who were paid by the number of dials they did, it was an unsustainable situation. Their numbers decreased until there were fewer than 100 women remaining. Helen Quinlan was one of those who got out, as did Catherine Sharb, in search of better paid employment. Helen became a typist, while Catherine found a job in the office of a roller bearing factory, and found that she loved it. "The girls at the office," she wrote, "were a sociable crowd. They had a club which they invited me to join. Most of the girls embroidered or crocheted, making things for their hope chests." Hope chests were also called dowry chests and contained items collected by young, single women in anticipation of marriage. In the spring of 1920, Catherine was 18, but she didn't seem in any hurry to settle down. She liked the nightlife too much for that. "I wasn't making anything for my hope chest," she wrote. "So while the girls worked, I played the piano and sang songs that were popular in those days." Grace Fryer was also canny enough to see the writing on the wall. Dial painting, for her, could only ever have been a stopgap job. It was something important to help the war effort, but it wasn't a long-term proposition for someone of her skills. She set her sights high and was thrilled to secure a position at the Fidelity, a high-end bank in Newark. She loved traveling to her office, her dark hair neatly set and an elegant string of pearls around her neck, ready to get to grips with work that challenged her. As with Catherine's new colleagues, the girls at the bank were sociable. Grace was the kind of girl who loved dancing and laughing, and she and her new work friends often hosted dry parties, for Prohibition had begun in January 1920. Grace also liked to swim in her spare time, propelling her lithe body through the local swimming pool as she kept fit. She thought the future looked bright, and she wasn't the only one. In Orange, Albina Maggia had met her man at last. It felt so wonderful to be courting after waiting all this time. Just when she'd started to feel really old, she was 25, years older than most girls wed at that time, and with a suddenly creaky left knee to boot. He had finally come along. James LaRice, a bricklayer and Italian immigrant who'd moved to the United States aged 17. He was a war hero, awarded a Purple Heart and one oak leaf cluster. Albina started to allow herself to dream of marriage and children, of finally moving out of the family home. Her sister, Molly, meanwhile, wasn't waiting for any knight in shining armor to come for her. Independent-minded, confident, and unmarried, she left her family to board in an all-female house on Highland Avenue, a tree-lined street in Orange with beautiful detached homes. Molly was still working at the radium company, one of the few girls left, but she was brilliant at her job and didn't want to leave. Every morning she went to work full of energy and enthusiasm, which was more than she could say for some of her colleagues. Marguerite Carlo, who could normally be relied on for a laugh, kept saying she felt tired all the time. Hazel Vincent, meanwhile, felt so run down that she decided to leave. She and Theo weren't yet married, so she got herself a job with the General Electric Company. But her new surroundings didn't improve her condition. Hazel had no idea what was wrong with her. The weight was dropping off her. She felt weak, and her jaw ached something rotten. She was so concerned that, in the end, she asked the company doctor at her new firm to examine her, but he was unable to diagnose her illness. The one thing she could be assured of, at least, was that it wasn't her work with radium that was the cause. In October 1920, her former employer was featured in the local news. The residue from radium extraction looked like seaside sand, and the company had offloaded this industrial waste by selling it to schools and playgrounds to use in their children's sandboxes. Kids' shoes were reported to have turned white because of it, while one little boy complained to his mother of a burning sensation in his hands. Yet, in comments that made reassuring reading, von Serhotsky pronounced the sand most hygienic for children to play in, more beneficial than the mud of world-renowned curative baths. Catherine Sharb certainly had no qualms about returning to work for the radium firm when she was headhunted at the end of November 1920 to train the new workers in the watch company studios. These were mostly based in Connecticut, including at the Waterbury Clock Company. Catherine taught scores of girls the method she herself had learned. "I instructed them," she said, "to put the brush in their mouth." The new girls were excited to be working with radium, for the unstoppable craze continued, brought to a fever pitch by a visit of Marie Curie to the United States in 1921. In January of that same year, as part of the constant press coverage of the element, von Terhotsky penned an article for American Magazine. "Locked up in radium is the greatest force the world knows," he opined gravely. "Through a microscope, you can see whirling, powerful, invisible forces, the uses of which," he admitted, "we do not yet understand." He added, as a cliffhanger on which to leave his readers, "What radium means to us today is a great romance in itself, but what it may mean to us tomorrow, no man can foretell." In fact, no man can foretell much, von Terhotsky included. And there was one event in particular that the doctor didn't see coming. In the summer of 1921, he was frozen out of his own company. His co-founder, George Willis, had sold a large share of his stock to the company treasurer, Arthur Roeder. Not long after that, both Willis and von Terhotsky were unceremoniously ousted in a corporate takeover. The newly named United States Radium Corporation, USRC, seemed destined for great things in the post-war world, but von Terhotsky wouldn't be at the helm to guide it through whatever lay ahead. Instead, it was Arthur Roeder who slipped graciously into the vacant president's chair. 5. Molly Maggia poked her tongue gingerly into the gap where her tooth had once been. Ouch! The dentist had removed it for her a few weeks ago after she'd gotten a toothache, but it was still incredibly sore. She gave herself a little shake and turned back to her dials. The studio was very quiet, she reflected. So many girls had gone. Jenny Stalker and Irene Rudolph had been laid off, and Irene's cousin Catherine had left for the second time. She and Edna Bowles both went to dial paint for the Luminite Corporation, another radium firm based in Newark. Of the original girls, it was really only the Smith and Carlo sisters left now, and Molly herself. Saddest of all, in her opinion, was that Ella Eckert had quit to go to Bamberger's. It sure wasn't the same place anymore, not since Roeder had taken over. Molly completed her tray of dials and stood to take it up to Miss Rooney. Despite herself, she found her tongue flicking back to that hole. The pain was just so nagging. If it didn't get better soon, she thought, she was going to go to the dentist again, and a different one this time, someone who really knew what he was doing. It didn't get better soon. And so, in October 1921, she made an appointment with a Dr. Joseph Kniff, a dentist who'd been recommended to her as an expert on unusual mouth diseases. For Molly, the appointment couldn't come soon enough. For several weeks, the pain in her lower gum and jaw had become so intense that it was almost unbearable. As Kniff ushered her into his office, she desperately hoped he would be able to help her. The other dentist had only seemed to make things worse. Kniff was a tall, middle-aged man with tortoiseshell glasses and an olive complexion. He gently probed Molly's gums and teeth, shaking his head as he examined the place where her tooth had been removed by the previous dentist. Although it had been over a month since it had been taken out, the socket had failed to heal. Kneph observed her inflamed gums and softly touched her teeth, several of which seemed a little loose. He nodded briskly, certain he had found the cause of the trouble. "I treated her," he later said, "for pyorrhea." This was a very common inflammatory disease, affecting the tissues around the teeth. Molly appeared to have all the symptoms. Kneph was sure that, with his expert care, her condition would soon improve. Yet, it didn't improve. Instead of responding to the treatment, Kneph recalled, the girl became steadily worse. It was so terribly, terribly sore. Molly had more teeth out as Kneph tried to stop the infection in its tracks by removing the source of her pain, but none of the extractions ever healed. Instead, ever more agonizing ulcers sprouted in the holes left behind, hurting her even more than the teeth had. Molly struggled on, continuing to work at the studio, even though using her mouth on the brush was extremely uncomfortable. Marguerite Carlo, who was feeling completely well again, tried to engage her in chatter, but Molly barely responded. It wasn't just the pain of her gums, which seemed to take up all her concentration, but the bad breath that came with it. There was a disagreeable odor whenever she opened her mouth, and she was embarrassed by it. At the end of November 1921, her sister Albina married James Larice. The wedding was held the day before Quinta's daughter's second birthday, and the bride found herself drinking in her niece's funny antics with a newly maternal air. Soon, she thought, she and James would have their own little ones running about. There was one cloud on the horizon, though, darkening the newlyweds' bliss. Molly. Even though Albina now rarely saw her as the two lived distantly, all of Molly's sisters couldn't help but be concerned by her deteriorating condition. For as the weeks passed, it wasn't just her mouth that became sore. She started to have aches and pains in completely unconnected places. "My sister," Quinta remembered, "began having trouble with her teeth and her jawbone and her hips and feet. We thought it rheumatism." The doctor administered aspirin and sent her home to Highland Avenue. At least she lived with an expert. One of the women she boarded with, 50-year-old Edith Mead, was a trained nurse, and she cared for Molly as best she could. But nothing in her training could make sense of this disease. She had never seen anything like it. Neither Kneph, nor Molly's family doctor, nor Edith seemed able to make her better. Every appointment brought forth another expensive doctor's bill, but no matter how much Molly spent, there was no cure. In fact, the more Kneph tried to help, and he employed some extreme methods of treatment, the worse Molly became, the worse her teeth were, and the ulcers, and her gums. Sometimes Kneph didn't even have to pull her teeth anymore. They fell out on their own. Nothing he did arrested the disintegration in the slightest degree. And disintegration was the word for it. Molly's mouth was literally falling apart. She was in constant agony, and only superficial palliatives brought her any relief. For Molly, a girl who had always loved to joke around, it was unbearable. Her smile, which had once been a toothy grin that beamed across her face, was unrecognizable as more and more of her teeth came out. Well, no matter. She was in too much pain to smile, anyway. As Christmas passed and the new year began, the doctors finally thought they had diagnosed her mysterious condition. Sores in the mouth, joint pain, extreme tiredness. A young single woman living outside the family home. Well, it was obvious, really. On January 24th, 1922, her physicians tested her for syphilis, or Cupid's disease, a sexually transmitted infection. But the test came back negative. The doctors would have to think again. By now, Dr. Kniff had noticed certain things about her case that made him doubt his initial diagnosis. It was, it appeared, an extraordinary affliction. It was almost like something was attacking her from the inside, though he knew not what it could be. As well as this seemingly unstoppable disintegration of her mouth, to his trained nostrils, the noticeable smell coming from her seemed peculiar. It differed decidedly from the odor commonly associated with the usual forms of necrosis of the jaw. Necrosis meant bone decay. Molly's teeth, those that were left, were literally rotting in her mouth. After conducting further research, Kniff reached a conclusion. She was, he determined, suffering from a condition not unlike phosphorus poisoning. It was the same suggestion Catherine Sharb's doctor had made when she'd had her outbreak of teenage spots a few years before. Phossy jaw, as the victims of phosphorus poisoning had grimly nicknamed the condition, had very similar symptoms to those that Molly was enduring, tooth loss, gum inflammation, necrosis, and pain. And so, at her next appointment, Kniff asked Molly how she was employed. "Painting numbers on watches so that they will shine at night," she responded, wincing as her tongue formed the words and touched the ulcers in her mouth. With that, his suspicions increased. Kniff decided to take matters into his own hands. He visited the radium plant, but received little cooperation. "I asked the radium people for the formula of their compound," he remembered, "but this was refused." Undark was, after all, a highly lucrative commercial property. The company couldn't share the top-secret formula with just anyone. Kniff was, however, told that no phosphorus was used, and assured that work in the factory could not have caused the disease. His own tests seemed to back up the firm's assertion. "I thought phosphorus might have been in the paint and caused her trouble," he later said, "but all the tests I made failed to show it." They were, it seemed, still in the dark. None of this helped Molly. By now the pain was excruciating. Her mouth had become a mass of sores. She could barely speak at all, let alone eat. It was horrifying for her sisters to watch. "She suffered such agony," said Quinta, "that it has unnerved me every time I recall it." Anyone who has ever endured an abscessed tooth may be able to imagine some small degree of her suffering. By now, Molly's entire lower jaw, the roof of her mouth, and even the bones of her ears might be said to be one huge abscess. There was no way in the world that she could work in such a condition. She quit her job at the Orange Studio, where she had spent so many happy hours painting dials, and was confined to her home. Surely, one day soon, the doctors would determine what was wrong and cure her, and she could get on with her life again. But no cure came. In May, Kniff suggested that she come in again to his office so that he could examine her and see what progress had been made. Molly limped into his office. The rheumatism in her hips and feet had grown worse, and she was almost lame. But it was her mouth that took up all her thoughts, all her time, and consumed her. There was no escape from the agony. She hobbled over to Dr. Kneff's dental chair and then leaned back. Gingerly, she opened her mouth for him. He bent over her and prepared to probe inside. There were barely any teeth left now, he saw. Red raw ulcers peppered the inside of her mouth instead. Molly tried to indicate that her jaw was hurting especially, and Kneff prodded delicately at the bone in her mouth. To his horror and shock, even though his touch had been gentle, her jawbone broke against his fingers. He then removed it, not by an operation, but merely by putting his fingers in her mouth and lifting it out. A week or so later, her entire lower jaw was removed in the same way. Molly couldn't bear it, but there was no relief. All the doctors could offer were analgesic drugs that barely helped. Her whole face, beneath her bouffant brown hair, was just pain, pain, pain. She became anemic, weakening further. Kneff, even though he wasn't a physician, nor proficient at the procedure, tested her for syphilis again on June 20th, and this time the results came back positive. Molly would probably have been devastated if she'd been told, but many doctors at that time kept diagnoses from their patients, and it is very likely Kneff didn't tell her, wanting her to concentrate on getting well. She would have known, had she heard the news, that it couldn't possibly be that. But she had no idea what the real cause could be. If anything, she should be full of health. Not only was she young, in her 20s, but she had worked with radium for years, for goodness sake. Only that February, the local paper had declared, "Radium may be eaten. It seems that in years to come we shall be able to buy radium tablets and add years to our lives." But for Molly, time, it seemed, was running out. After her jaw had gone, an important discovery was made. Kneff had always hoped that by removing a tooth or a piece of infected bone, the progress of the mysterious disease would be halted. But now it became evident that, whenever a portion of the affected bone was removed, instead of arresting the course of the necrosis, it speeded it up. Over the summer, Molly's condition deteriorated even further. She was getting painfully sore throats now, though she knew not why. Her jaw, at times, would spontaneously bleed, and Edith would press white cotton bandages to her face, trying to stem the flow. September 1922. In Newark, Molly's former colleague Edna Bowles was preparing to wed. Her husband-to-be was Louis Hussman, a plumber of German heritage with blue eyes and dark hair. He was devoted to her. She laid out her accoutrements with touching anticipation, the bridal gown, her stockings, her wedding shoes. Not long now. Not long now. They are words of excitement, expectation, and reassurance to those in pain. Not long now. In September 1922, the peculiar infection that had plagued Molly Maggia for less than a year spread to the tissues of her throat. The disease slowly ate its way through her jugular vein. On September 12th, at 5 p.m., her mouth was flooded with blood as she hemorrhaged so fast that Edith could not staunch it. Her mouth, empty of teeth, empty of jawbone, empty of words, filled with blood instead, until it spilled over her lips and down her stricken, shaken face. It was too much. She died, her sister Quinta said, a painful and terrible death. She was just 24 years old. Her family knew not what to do with themselves, knew not what could have happened to take her from them so suddenly. She died, and the doctor said they didn't just know from what, remembered Albina. The family tried to find out. Albina added, "My elder sister went down to Dr. Kneff's office. We were told after her death that she died of syphilis." Syphilis. What a shameful, sad little secret. The final medical bills came in, addressed to the girl's father, Valerio, and labeled for Amelia. Her family doctor reduced, on request, the amount he charged them. But though it was a welcome gesture, it couldn't bring Molly back. They buried her on Thursday, September 14th, 1922, in Rosedale Cemetery, Orange, in a wooden coffin with a silver nameplate. It was inscribed, simply, Amelia Maggia. Before they said their goodbyes, her loved ones laid out her clothes, her white dress, her stockings, her black leather pumps. Gently, they clothed her body in the garments, and then Molly was laid to rest. Her family hoped that now, at last, she would find peace. 6. Ottawa, Illinois, United States of America, September 1922. 2 days after Molly's funeral, and 800 miles away from Orange, a small advertisement appeared in the local paper of a little town called Ottawa in Illinois. "Girls wanted," it declared. And then it continued, "Several girls, 18 years or over, for fine brushwork. This is a studio proposition. The work is clean and healthful. Surroundings pleasant. Apply to Miss Murray, Old High School Building, 1022 Columbus Street." It sounded wonderful. Ottawa was a tiny town, population 10,816, located 85 miles southwest of Chicago. It billed itself as a genuine American community in its town directory, and those words were on the money. It was the kind of place where its banks proclaimed themselves to be where friendliness reigns, and local businesses advertised their location as being one block north of post office. Ottawa was in the heart of rural Illinois, surrounded by farmland and the impossibly wide skies of the Midwest. It was a place where folks were happy simply to get on with life, raise their families, do good work, live decent lives. The community was close-knit and emphatically religious. Ottawa was a small town of many churches, with the majority of residents Catholic. "The citizens of Ottawa," chirped the town directory, "are liberal-minded, prosperous, and progressive." The perfect populace, then, for this new dial-painting opportunity. It wasn't the United States Radium Corporation hiring, although they knew their competitor well. The employer was the Radium Dial Company. Its president was Joseph A. Kelly. He was based at the head office in Chicago, however, so it was to Miss Murray, the studio's superintendent, the Ottawa girls applied. Lottie Murray was an immensely loyal employee, a slim, single woman, 44 years old, who had been with the company 5 years, as it moved its studio around various locations before settling now in Ottawa. One of her very first successful applicants was 19-year-old Catherine Wolfe. She was Ottawa-born and bred, a devoted parishioner of St. Columba Church, which was located diagonally opposite the studio. Despite her young age, Catherine had already had some hard knocks in life. When she was only 6, her mother Bridget had passed away. Just 4 years later, in 1913, her father Maurice died from lung trouble. As a result, 10-year-old Catherine had been sent to live with her elderly aunt and uncle, Mary and Winchester Moody Biggert, sharing their home at 520 East Superior Street. Catherine was a shy, quiet person who was very unassuming. She had thick, jet-black hair and very pale skin. She was a rather neat woman with tidy limbs who didn't go in for showy gestures. The job at the studio would be her first, painting the dials of timepieces and aeronautical instruments. It was fascinating work, and the pay was good, she enthused, but every line had to be just so. And there was only one known way to get the necessary point on the Japanese brushes the size of a pencil that the Ottawa girls used. Miss Lottie Murray taught us how to point camel hair brushes with our tongues, Catherine remembered. We would first dip the brush into water, then into the powder, and then point the ends of the bristles between our teeth. It was the lip, dip, paint routine all over again, but with an entirely new cast. Joining Catherine at the studio was 16-year-old Charlotte Nevins. The ad had said 18 years or over, but she wasn't going to let a little thing like that stop her. All her friends were there, and she wanted to join them. Charlotte was the youngest of 6 siblings, and perhaps she just wanted to grow up fast. She was a cheerful, caring girl who, like Catherine, was a devout Catholic. Though she was generally quiet, she could be pretty outspoken when she needed to be. Charlotte wasn't the only one to tweak the truth about her age. Another employee who did the same, though the company must have known, was Mary Vicini, a sweet Italian girl who had come to America as a baby. She was only 13 in 1922, but nonetheless made it into the coveted workforce. In truth, the nimble fingers of prepubescent girls suited the delicate work of dial painting. Records show that some were as young as 11. Assisting Miss Murray with the applicants were Mr. and Mrs. Reed. Rufus Reed was the assistant superintendent, a 39-year-old New Yorker who was a company man to his bones. Tall and bald-headed, he was medium-built and wore dark-framed glasses. He was, in fact, deaf, but it didn't hinder him in his work. Perhaps his disability made him all the more grateful to the firm that had treated him well. Like Miss Murray, Reed and his wife, Mercedes, who worked there as an instructress, had been with the company for years. Mercy Reed was famed for her instructing. She ate the luminous material with a spatula to show the girls that it was harmless, licking it right in front of them. Charlotte Nevins remembered, "When I was working in the plant painting dials, they always told me the radium would never hurt me. They even encouraged us to paint rings on our fingers and paint our dress buttons and buckles." And the girls did exactly as instructed. They were a happy, jolly lot, and they frequently practiced their painting, especially in the fields of fashion and art. Lots of them took paint home. One woman even painted her walls with it for interior decoration with a difference. Radium Dial seems not to have been as concerned as USRC had been about wasting material. Former employees report that the radium was handled carelessly and, in contrast to the brushing down in Orange, washing was a voluntary procedure, and not many of the workers made use of the washing facilities. Why would they, when they could go home glowing like angels? The girls were the envy of others in the little Illinois town when they stepped out with their boyfriends at night, their dresses and hats and sometimes even their hands and faces aglow with the phosphorescence of the luminous paint, a newspaper reported. A young local girl recalled, "I used to wish I could work there. It was the elite job for the poor working girls." When the Dial painters visited the drugstore for homemade candies or carbonated ice cream, they left a trail of glowing dust behind them. Catherine remembered, "When I went home and washed my hands in a dark bathroom, they would appear luminous and ghostly. My clothes, hanging in a dark closet, gave off a phosphorescent glare. When I walked along the street, I was aglow from the radium powder." The women were humorously termed the ghost girls. They worked 6 days a week, using a similar greenish-white paint to that used in Orange, with identical ingredients, and the girls were expected to work, work, work. They did get a lunch break, but Mrs. Reed ate her food at her painting desk, and although a number of the girls popped home or went to nearby coffee shops, the majority chose to stay in the studio, following their instructress's example. Catherine recalled, "We used to eat our lunches right beside the workbenches near the luminous paint and brushes which we used. We hurried as fast as we could. After all, we made more money that way." The girls declared, "We were extremely happy in our work," and Radium Dial was equally content. It followed the attitude of its main client, West Clocks. Their manual for employees read, "We expect you to work hard, and the pay is accordingly large. If you do not expect to work hard and carefully, you are in the wrong place." But for Catherine and Charlotte and Mary, this place felt very, very right indeed. 7. Newark, New Jersey, November 1922. "Miss Irene Rudolph?" Irene got tentatively to her feet as she heard her name being called by Dr. Barry and shuffled into his office. Her trouble had first started in her feet. Though they were currently the least of her worries, she could just about get by if she took things slow. Her family, including her cousin Catherine Sharp, helped out a lot. It was now her mouth that was the real problem. She had been attending this dental practice since August, though she'd been having tooth trouble since the spring of 1922. Despite the attentions of various dentists, her condition had worsened, so much so that, in May, she'd had to give up her job in a corset factory. Without a job, yet with increasing medical bills, Irene soon found her financial position precarious. She'd been sensible when she'd worked as a dial painter, squirreling away her high wages, but her mysterious condition had exhausted her hard-earned savings. With every expensive appointment, she hoped for improvement. As she levered herself into Dr. Barry's chair, she opened her mouth wide and prayed that, this time, he would have good news to offer. Walter Barry, an experienced dentist of 42, examined Irene's mouth with deepening confusion. He and his partner, Dr. James Davidson, had been operating on Irene since the summer. Yet, Every course of treatment they tried, such as cutting out the diseased bone in her mouth and removing teeth, seemed only to increase her suffering. Their surgery was located at 516 Broad Street, practically opposite the Newark Public Library. Yet, it appeared, no textbook or medical journal on the shelves of the library or their own practice contained the solution. As Barry examined Irene's butchered mouth at this latest appointment on November 8, 1922, he could see that, still, there was only more infection, inflaming her empty gums with an unhealthy yellow sheen. James Davidson had experience of treating Fossey Jaw, and he and Barry now became convinced this was Irene's trouble. "I immediately started to question Irene as to what her occupation was," Barry recalled. "I made an effort to ascertain whether there was any phosphorus in this material she was using." Unknowingly, he was following in the footsteps of Dr. Kneff, who had treated Molly Maggia. But the two investigations didn't cross, nor did Kneff have the opportunity to share his own discovery, how Molly's jaw was destroyed faster and faster the more of her he removed. The same accelerated decline was now affecting Irene. Barry told his patient it was his opinion she was suffering from some occupational trouble. But, as Catherine Sharb later noted, the word radium was never brought into it. Radium was such an established medical boon that it was almost beyond reproach. People didn't question it. And so, although there was some suspicion that the luminous paint was to blame for Irene's condition, culprit number one was phosphorus. In December, Irene took a turn for the worse and was admitted to the hospital. She was shockingly pale and found to be anemic, and it was in the hospital that she decided she was not going to lie down and suffer quietly. For although Irene's dentists may not have crossed paths with Kniff, the dial painter's friendships were a stronger network. By now, Irene had heard about Molly Maggia's death. The gossip mongers were saying syphilis had killed her, but the girls who knew her found that hard to believe. And so, while in the hospital, Irene told her doctor that there had been another girl who'd had symptoms just like hers, who died only a few months before. The Maggia family were trying to move on with their lives without their sister. That winter, Quinta was pregnant again, and Albina was hoping that any month now she would have the same good news to announce. But for Irene, sitting weakly in her hospital room, Molly's death was definitely not something in the past, but somehow horribly present. And then she told the doctor something else. Another girl, she said, was sick. She could have meant Helen Quinlan, who had been taken ill with a severe sore throat and swollen face, which had inflamed her pixie features. She, too, had had trouble with a tooth and was beginning to show signs of anemia. But Helen appears not to have moved in the same social circles as Irene. It was Hazel Vincent to whom she referred. Since Hazel had left USRC, she had become more and more ill. She had been told that she was suffering from anemia and pyorrhea. Her doctor, too, suspected Fossey Jaw from the black discharge with its garlic odor oozing from her mouth and nose. Hazel's childhood sweetheart, Theo, was worried sick about her. In Irene's opinion, Hazel's case and hers were just too similar to be discounted as mere coincidence. Carefully, she set out the parallels during a consultation with Dr. Allen at the hospital, trying to make him see that there was something more going on. And as the doctor listened to his patient talk, he'd heard enough. All the evidence suggested that it was an occupational problem. On December 26, 1922, Allen reported Irene Rudolph as a case of phosphorus poisoning to the Industrial Hygiene Division and asked them to investigate. The authorities launched straight into action, and within days, an inspector was at the Orange plant looking into the claims of industrial poisoning. The inspector was escorted up to the dial painting studio by Harold Veit, a vice president of USRC who had responsibility for operations. Together, they quietly observed the girls at work. There were not many of them there. Dial painting in Orange had become almost a seasonal occupation, so the girls did not work continuously anymore. Yet the inspector noted with some incredulity the universal practice of lip pointing. This was called to the attention of Mr. Veit, who was quick to address the concerns. Veit told him, the inspector reported, that he has warned the girls time and time again of this dangerous practice, but he could not get them to stop it. Had the dial painters overheard this conversation, they would probably have been stunned. Other than Sabin von Sahotsky's one-off warning to Grace Fryer that lip-pointing would make her ill, not a single other dial painter, including the instructresses and forewomen, ever reported a warning being issued, and certainly not one that included reference to lip-pointing being a dangerous practice. On the contrary, they had received countless assurances of the exact opposite. When the company deigned to concern itself with their work processes, that was. On the whole, the firm left them to get on with their work without interference. It didn't, in truth, really seem to care just how the women dial painted, as long as the material wasn't wasted and the work got done. The inspector continued to observe the girls. One, he noticed, a rather matronly woman who was older than the rest, appeared to be limping as she carried her dials up to the new forelady, Josephine Smith, who had recently been promoted. Miss Rooney would be leaving to join the Luminite Corporation. Sarah Mileffer was limping. She was getting old, she supposed. She was now 33. And you should expect a few more aches and pains as you got older. Plus, it was exhausting being a working mother. She didn't have the energy to keep up with her sister Marguerite, let alone her 11-year-old daughter. She felt blessed that the company was so understanding about her limp. A foreman of the company took her to and from work each day because of this trouble. The inspection concluded with the official taking a paint sample for testing. He sent it to John Roach, the deputy commissioner of the New Jersey Department of Labor, with a recommendation that Roach's team make a survey of this plant, as it is outside our jurisdiction. Consequently, an additional inspection took place in the next few weeks, with the inspector, Lillian Erskine, delivering her findings to Roach on January 25th. Erskine took a rather different approach from the first inspector. As part of her investigation, she spoke with a radium authority and informed Roach that no reports of necrosed bones as a result of radium treatment exist. She therefore concluded, this case, Irene Rudolph, and the reported second case, Hazel Vincent, are probably an accidental coincidence resulting from abscessed teeth and incompetent dental surgery. Roach arranged for the paint to be tested by Dr. Martin Zamatulski, a chemist. Zamatulski was an educated man and thought it extremely unlikely any phosphorus would be in the paint, as this had never been hinted at as an ingredient. Without having run a single test, he wrote sagely to Roach on January 30th, 1923, It is my belief that the serious condition of the jaw has been caused by the influence of radium. This was a radical idea. Yet Zamatulski's off-the-wall suggestion did have some science to back it up. In a bibliography of radium studies that USRC itself had published just 4 months before, there was an article headed, "Radium Dangers